Thanks for joining me today. My guest today is Dr. Robin Tiger. Robin has a very interesting journey to share with us today. Robin's interest in medicine began at an early age. You will hear during this podcast how she is now helping physicians practice self-care, improving their wellness, and decreasing the stress in their lives. Robin's journey from a practicing radiologist to her current role is a very personal one, and I very much appreciate that she is willing to share it with my audience today. There is a tremendous value in her story for each and every one of us. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Bedside. I am your host, Dr. Norm Chapin. Beyond the Bedside is a podcast that will help you find a non-clinical role and take your career in new, rewarding, and sometimes unanticipated directions. I'm very happy that you are here to learn about opportunities beyond the bedside. Welcome to another episode of Physicians Beyond the Bedside. Tonight, I'm very excited to be interviewing a guest that I've been looking forward to interviewing for quite some time now, Robin Tiger. Robin is going to share with us tonight her current role and the areas that she is specializing in and focusing on to help physicians become more stress-free. So, Robin, thank you for coming on the show. I'm very, very pleased that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really enjoying your show, Norm, so thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you. So to start with, maybe you could give my audience just kind of an introduction into what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, so essentially I am what doctors have come to call me, the self-care doctor. And what I do is that I teach other physicians how to decrease the stress in their lives through learning how to take over their hijacked nervous systems and their hijacked minds, naturally and simply with just evidence-based tools that we already have within us, but we are never taught in medical school.
So how did you come to this type of practice that you have? What was your road to this particular passion and focus that you have on physician wellness and stress management?
Well, I'm basically a product of the product, or as they say, make your mess your message. So several years ago, maybe about a decade or more, really, I was a burned out physician. And it was a time period when we really didn't talk about this kind of stuff. It really wasn't out there like it is now. I really didn't know what was going on. I, at the time, had two little kids and a husband and a dog and taking care of the house. And I was on all kinds of boards and committees in the community and the schools and practicing radiology. And I started to develop lots of illnesses that, as a physician, you know, you try to put it all together, right? We try to lump things together and syndromes and things to make sense of it, but I couldn't. And things that were happening to me were these migraine headaches that I'd never experienced before, with vomiting, right? Just this violent vomiting. And I had bleeding gums. What does that have to do with migraines? Couldn't figure that out. Vertigo, tinnitus, couldn't stay awake and I couldn't fall asleep at night. And somebody would just call my name. I'd turn my head ever so gently and I would be very dizzy and have to wait for that to pass. My whole body hurt. Like I would wake up in the morning and I would feel like the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, you know, like I'm kind of making a joke here, but seriously, like I couldn't move. Like I just felt like everything hurt. And I had bad digestion, like anything I ate, my abdomen would distend, it would hurt, my bowel habits were totally off. And the really, really scary symptom that I had was that I developed these paresthesias in my hands and my feet and the left side of my back. And they would just come and go as they pleased. I couldn't really nail down when or why or how. And they were very, very terrifying. Like I was terrified I had some debilitating neurologic disease. And the scariest things I remember were maybe being, for example, during a breast biopsy. And, you know, I would be there with the biopsy gun and right there at the lesion. And I'm just standing there. My tech would say, "Hey, Dr. Tiger, looks good to me. You're right there." And I'd be like, "Yeah, I'm just checking, just checking." But the truth was, I couldn't pull the trigger on the biopsy gun because I couldn't feel my hands or my fingers. And I'd have to wait for that to pass so I could do the procedure. So, you know, Norm, we don't ever want to be an interesting case, right? So that's essentially what I saw myself as, right? As doctors, we want to figure out interesting cases, but we don't ever want to be one.
That's true.
And that's what I became.
That sounds terrifying.
Right? It was terrifying. And it didn't all happen at once. It was hard for me to realize that over time, these things were accumulating. And I started to have some dark thoughts too. So all this is going on. I'm trying to balance practicing medicine, taking care of my family. I'm feeling horrible. And my brain starts telling me bad words, things that, you know, like, do you really want to be here? Maybe it's better if you weren't here, you know, and so on. And I had 3 physician colleagues die from suicide. And so I was really scared. And so that was the beginning of the bottom, essentially.
How long was it from the time that you first noticed the headaches and those initial symptoms until you hit this nadir where you really started to question whether life was really worthwhile?
Sort of interesting, because in retrospect, I'm remembering a lot of these symptoms beginning to show themselves during my residency. But I wasn't really thinking about it. I remember having to go into a dark room sometimes when I was reading cases, and I would think that the headaches were maybe just because of the lights in the view boxes, because we were actually on film at that point. Right? We didn't have digital, right? And the digestion would come and go during that point. So it sort of seemed to creep up, mm-hmm. beginning at some time in residency, and then, you know, little by little continue into practice. And it probably peaked at about 10 years into practice,
okay.
I would say, is when I really started to notice that things were flaring up.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's interesting that you were having these. Obviously, you're an interventional radiologist. You're doing breast biopsies and those kinds of things. But I think mm-hmm. many physicians in different specialties, if you had to have them rank the specialties which would have the lowest amount of burnout, the lowest amount of stress in their lives, you'd have to think that dermatology and probably radiology might be the two that were near the lower part of that list as compared to neurosurgery or emergency medicine, those types of things. It's interesting to me that you developed all these problems, which we'll get to this part of your story later, I'm sure, but you really came to realize that you were suffering from burnout and stress-related problems, it sounds like.
Yeah, at the time, I didn't know that. And it is funny, the perception of the radiologist would be, you know, wearing the nice clothes and having the hair done and all these kinds of things. I've heard all sort of jokes, tennis racket in hand and whatnot. But, you know, radiology initially, when I went into it, was amazing. We were in a reading room and we had actual films, and it was a very intellectually stimulating, collaborative type of practice where we helped each other, and all the teams would come down and we'd go over things with the surgeons and the internists and the pediatricians and the infectious disease docs and, you know, so on. And it was a great way to practice medicine. And then the digital age really changed everything. It seems like technology is better, but in a lot of ways, it really was the downturn of how we were feeling as radiologists, how we practiced, because we went from that situation to talking into a voice-activated dictaphone in a dark room, reading case after case on a computer alone, and 9 to 10 hours a day doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the clinicians could see their own cases on their own computers. They got their transcriptions really quickly, the reports, and it became very isolating. And then the RVUs became quantity over quality as importance. Mm-hmm. So there were specific things that happened that added to why that burnout occurred. There's this overwhelm of, you know, what's going on in medicine, and we have this umbrella of the healthcare system being broken, and all of those things are true. But then the subcategory is that different areas of medicine have their own problems and their own issues. And these are the issues that we had with radiology.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of interesting, and it's just an aha moment for me, because I know that burnout can affect any specialty, and I guess I just had not realized. But speaking with a lot of interventional radiologists, they do echo your sentiments that the job has become very commoditized. They feel like they're to do what the consulting physician wants as soon as the consulting physician wants it. And my role is more in the inpatient setting right now, so not as much outpatient. But when someone needs an IR procedure, many times in an inpatient setting, it can be a fairly urgent intervention that needs to be done. And I've just never really thought about the amount of stress that exposes the radiologist to always be responding to those kinds of more urgent types of situations. And it's interesting. So
I actually found the procedures to be a reprieve. I enjoyed had the patient contact and doing the procedures. Sitting in a dark room 9 to 10 hours a day on non-interventional days. Those were the tough ones. That's the hamster on the wheel. That's this isolating one, you know. Who wants to sit by themselves talking to themselves?
Yeah.
And the problem became, like I said, the RVUs, it became a commodity. So you're judged by the amount of revenue you bring in. Mm-hmm. So the person who's sitting reading MRIs all day, you know, they look like they're bringing a lot more revenue in than the individual who's reading x-rays or mammograms. Or even if you're doing procedures, you don't get paid to talk to the patient, to talk to the referring clinician, to call them later on that night, to talk to the family. You know, so there was a shift in, you know, the support that the radiologists were giving one another as well, because mm-hmm. when you're not reading cases, you're not getting RVUs, and therefore it looks bad. And, you know, I'm not a person to give up quality over quantity. You know, I quantity over quality. Like for me, I want to be the best doctor I can be. I want to compare to prior studies. I want to speak to referring clinicians. I want to see if my patients are okay. And that became a very ethical dilemma for me. So it was very stressful.
So when talking about burnout, this concept of moral injury is coming into the discussion much more. So for you, it sounds like the moral injury was, I can't talk with the patients. I can't interact with other physicians to make sure that I'm giving them. I can't compare to the old studies to make sure that I'm doing the best job I need to do. And that created this turmoil or led to some of the burnout feelings that you were having.
Yeah. So I actually was still practicing the way I wanted, but it would take longer, right? And so, you know, when you have the chairman of surgery coming and bringing you his personal studies because he trusts you, or his family studies, or cases that weren't compared to priors because radiologists were cutting corners because they have to get those RVUs, mm-hmm. you know, I'm still staying there longer and I'm doing more, but I'm practicing the way I want to. But then you get your wrist slapped. So it was very difficult. And still is.
And you give up some of that work-life balance that with kids and family is so important to maintain our sense of who we are and well-being, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me, how did you decide to pursue a career in medicine in the first place? What led to your interest in becoming a physician and then your interest in radiology as a specialty?
Well, for the first question, I would say my third grade teacher. So I was 8 years old and she mm-hmm. rolled out this life-size skeleton and I thought skeletons were Halloween costumes and decorations. And I didn't know that a skeleton was actually inside our bodies and that was the infrastructure of who we were. And I remember that very moment when she was explaining that to us and I just was fascinated. And I knew at 8 years old that I wanted to be a doctor.
Okay.
Yeah. And then radiology, how'd that come about? Well, I went through every rotation, internal medicine. Oh, I love that. Surgery. Oh, I love that. Peds. I love that. I did that for almost 2 years, right? In all of our rotations, I loved everything. I mean, certain things, you know, for different reasons than others, but I really did enjoy so much. And when it came down to it, there was this book in the library that the librarian recommended to me at my medical school. And it was a book that had asked different specialties in medicine, different doctors, different questions. And you have to answer the questions yourself too. And then you can compare your answers with the different doctors and the specialties and all kinds of things like, you know, what does your day look like? How many hours do you want to work? You know, what is the money you expect? You know, all kinds of things. Do you like to work with your hands? You know, things like that. And it's interesting that it came out that radiology was one of the top things. And when I went through my radiology rotation as a fourth year, I was just so fascinated with being able to look inside people's bodies and figure out what's going on. And I wasn't limited to a certain gender or a certain age group or a certain type of disease or illness. The world was open, which was really exciting to me.
So the breadth of the specialty and was one of the exciting things about it, it sounds like. You were dealing with all sorts of disease pathologies and different age groups and different even imaging modalities. I mean, it's a very diverse field. And I think it was getting more diverse as interventional radiology and those types of techniques came into play as well. It wasn't just the diagnostic imaging. So that's pretty interesting, though, that your first attraction to medicine was a skeleton And then years later, you decide to go into radiology. I think that's fascinating because maybe you knew at eight what you didn't realize until you were in your mid-20s, whenever you decided to specialize.
It's true. I thought I was going to be a pediatrician or an OBGYN going into medicine. And it's frequently common that a doctor has a perception of what a particular field is. And then you get into it and, you know, maybe you say, oh, okay, on the inside, it doesn't look exactly as I thought on the outside. You know, I think pediatricians and OBGYNs are amazing, but I saw myself in going in a different direction. So really getting in there and experiencing the different rotations and experiencing from the inside is, you know, that's where it comes from, how you figure out, you know, what's best for you.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit now, here you are going back to the situation that when you were severely burned out, you'd hit that low point. Mm-hmm. How did you finally realize what your problem was?
So I had been taking a lot of meds and they weren't working because I saw all kinds of doctors, right? The periodontist, the neurologist, the internist, the gastroenterologist, and the mental health care professional. And I was on all these pills and I wasn't getting better. And the imaging studies, of course, I'm a radiologist. So I was like hopping in the magnet. I was getting ultrasounds. I mean, you name it, I imaged it and they were all negative and nothing was helping. And so at this point, I didn't feel that anything I learned in Western medicine was going to be my answer. And as I mentioned earlier, I was terrified. Like I was really scared and I was scared for my life. And I had these three physician colleagues, almost like they were talking to me, you know, had passed away from suicide. They died from suicide. And it was, I could go like a fork in the road. I could follow in their path, which was really frightening. Or I could try and figure out, you know, what else can I do to help myself? Is there something else out there? And so I started hearing about things like yoga and meditation, for example. And I had always done the eye roll, whether it was visible or quietly. You know, I'd be on the treadmill training for my next race, looking at those people in that room down there doing all these things that I expected, you know, preconceived notions, twisting their bodies and turning upside down and listening to weird music and, you know, sitting in uncomfortable positions for long periods of time and wearing all kinds of weird spandex. And I mean, anybody listening, you may have some of these preconceived notions that I did. But it's interesting that it was more and more in the media and more out there that I was reading about it, hearing about it. And I said, you know, I have nothing to lose because I seriously was like at the bottom. I can only take a step up and I don't want to go myself. So I asked my neighbor who's a nurse and I said, hey, you know, there's this yoga 101 5-week series, like 5 minutes from here in this studio. Do you want to go with me? She kind of did the eye roll. I said, look, if it's terrible, we'll just leave and I'll take you to dinner.
Not a bad deal.
You know, what could she say? She gets dinner, right?
Yeah.
And we get out of the house. And so we went. And so we went the first time and I just, you know, sheepishly kind of walked in. And it was a very informal kind of class. It wasn't anything like I expected. There were question and answers happening the whole time. And at the end of the class, I just remember feeling completely shifted. Like I was reset. Like I felt really calm and I really focused and really awake. Even though I had worked a really long day, that time in the evening, I would be like trying to keep myself awake and I just felt amazing. Mm-hmm. And so that was the beginning of my left brain saying, what is the physiology responsible for this shift that I just had? Because my doctor brain needs to know the why behind everything. And that was my very first experience into something different than what we had learned traditionally in medicine.
Mm-hmm. So after that one class, it sounds like you felt differently enough that you obviously decided to pursue that path a little bit longer and see if it would produce any kind of a sustained result. What were the next steps that you took? I guess would be a better question.
Well, I finished out the 5-week series and then I continued going to classes in yoga and meditation as a student of the school. And I decided that because I was so curious and I was so interested in learning more, the best way to learn more would be going to teacher training, yoga teacher training, never thinking I would teach another person anything.
Okay.
It was really just my thirst for knowledge to understand why I was feeling better. Why some of my symptoms started to get better. I noticed that things were starting to get better. And I went into teacher training, which is a base level of 200 hours. And it was there that I learned about the field of yoga therapy.
Okay.
And that there was this field of yoga therapy which takes the base level of knowledge in yoga teacher training, builds on it, and teaches you how to work with certain individuals who are experiencing symptoms, illness, and diseases in a safe and effective way. I said, wow, that's amazing. I would love to learn how to do that. In particular, at that time, I'd always wanted to help people who have cancer since I spent so much time diagnosing cancer and watching the debilitation that occurred. I wanted to help military veterans, having spent so much time at the VA and watching, you know, what happens with them as they suffer from post-traumatic stress and all the medications they're on, and always thinking there was more that I wanted to do, but I didn't know how to help them. And so I said, I need to study this. I need to become certified in this. And I went on to become certified in yoga therapy and meditation. Yoga therapy was 1,000 hours of training over a 3-year period, and meditation was another 3 years. And what happened then, Norm, is that all of those symptoms I described to you went away completely.
That's amazing.
Dark thoughts, the paresthesias, the migraines, I mean, everything went away.
Were you practicing radiology this entire time?
No. In order for me to pursue this, I couldn't possibly have been practicing and going through all this training.
I mean, that's an amazing number of hours of training to get this certification.
Yeah, that's the base level of yoga therapy, because I went on to study more deeply and become certified in other areas of interest to me, such as trauma and stress, mm-hmm. and working with, like I mentioned, the populations of cancer and our military, and, you know, bringing in these different areas that I needed more knowledge in so that I could be of better service to individuals that I wanted to help.
Tell me a little bit, and this was a question I wrote down because I wasn't familiar with the term trauma-informed. And at first I thought, well, she's probably a radiologist who specializes in taking imaging of physically traumatized people. And I'm like, don't be an idiot. They can't be what it means. It has to be something related to the mind-body connection, right? But what does it mean and what does it involve to get certification and be what is referred to on your website as trauma-informed?
Yeah, I'm currently on the faculty of trauma-informed yoga therapy, and I travel nationally and teach trainings to mental health care professionals and yoga professionals. And why that is important is that it teaches you how to create a safe space for individuals who have trauma, really meeting them where they are. And that means the language that you use, that means the way you set up the space, predominantly, you know, in person. Now we're doing a lot of virtual space, but even so, you know, the space that you create, you know, and the types of things that you can teach them that would be safe and effective. You know, what would trigger somebody? What wouldn't trigger somebody most likely? You know, how can you use your words in a way to teach them to, you know, breathe in a certain way or move in a certain way, or meditation? What meditation is safe? The meditation I facilitate and I'm certified in is a trauma-informed meditation called iRest, which was originally created for Walter Reed Army Hospital to help our military relieve suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it's a very secular, safe meditation. And so mm-hmm. trauma-informed is an education that teaches you how to create a safe space and work safely with individuals who have had trauma.
So is it any type of emotional trauma that people suffered? You mentioned Walter Reed. I mean, they have a large number of patients there who do suffer primarily emotional trauma, but they also suffer just devastating physical losses and trauma as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, really putting all that together in, you know, the emotional piece, the physical piece. You know, when I train to work with military veterans, I've learned how to work with people who have amputations, you know, people who have brain injury, TBI. Mm-hmm. So there are physical injuries, there are emotional injuries, and they really are connected because our mind and our bodies are connected in a lot of ways.
I have a special offer for you today. I have created a list of the top 10 skills physicians need to be maximally effective in leadership roles. The skills I included on the list have been studied and found to increase the effectiveness of leaders in all organizations. You need to cultivate these skills when you assume a leadership role. Physicians are leaders not only in clinical settings, but in non-clinical settings as well. These skills will benefit you whether you are at the bedside or beyond. please visit my website at beyondthebedside.net/top10leadership skills for your free copy of this excellent resource today. I will also place a link to this resource in the show notes. Feel free to click on that in the show notes below. So you started out on a journey to help yourself, found out sort of serendipitously that this was helping you heal from the stress that you were under, and some might even use the words, the trauma that you were undergoing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you realized, A, that it was an area that you were fascinated by, curious about, and you begin taking the additional training. And it sounds like initially you still didn't have an idea that you would turn this into a vocation or a business. When did you realize that what you were learning and teaching and becoming very passionate and knowledgeable about was something that was desperately needed and that you could leverage into a full-time occupation?
Yeah, it was a process over this last almost decade, really, because as you know, when you practice as a doctor, right, it takes time for you to educate yourself and to get the experience that you need. So it definitely took several years of education and experience. And along the way, I was beginning to implement teaching workshops, teaching classes, teaching courses, and being asked to present at conferences and teach for different programs. And it sort of built itself up as I got more knowledge, as I got more familiar, as my experience increased, so did my opportunities. And last year, when COVID hit, I decided to really pivot to helping our physician colleagues. I had been helping them all along. They've been taking courses with me. I work closely with the medical society and so on. But I felt that I needed to really dedicate what I was doing to help our physicians. And I saw what we now know as an increase in burnout, increase in depression, an expected increase in suicide happening. And we know from Medscape stats earlier this year that those things are increasing. So last year, I really created that pivot, and I, you know, didn't know anything about creating programming, and I took a lot of courses and learned how to take everything from my brain and put it into an online content. You know, I created a home studio and did all of my audio and visual programming, got all of the lessons together and editing and lights and mics and cameras and you name it. And I decided to create some programs, and I then worked hard, diligently, to have them all CME accredited, because I wanted physicians to get credit and hopefully get them paid for by learning how to take care of themselves.
Great.
And that's where Stress-Free MD came from.
So that's really a recent brand for you, Stress-Free MD. You were doing a lot of work, it sounds like, before the past year, but you just, the COVID really created the pivot for you, I guess.
Yes, it did for many. So I was been in this space, like I said, for almost a decade, and I was working with several populations, but I really decided to dedicate my time to our colleagues. And so I understand how they think. I understand how they learn. I understand the language that they need to learn. And I've learned that over this past decade. And I basically took all of that and created content that made the most sense for them.
So how has that worked out for you in the past year? Has it been more successful than you thought, less successful than you thought? Is it pretty much having the penetration into the physician community about where you expected it to be? What results have you been getting?
Yeah, I don't really have any expectations as to, you know, what to expect, really, except that I just wanted to be of service and be of help. Mm-hmm. And it's been amazing. You know, the physicians that have come through my programs or have coached me privately have done incredibly. And the things I have heard are things like, because of you, I'm still in my marriage. Mm-hmm. Because of you, I didn't leave my medical practice. You know, because of you, I go to work every day and I'm joy practicing medicine again. I no longer chart into the evening. I get all my charting done during the day. My body doesn't hurt anymore. I'm sleeping for the first time in years. You know, my kids think I am cool again. You know, my digestion is good. I have focus and concentration. I'm not getting sick as much, and so on. And so, you know, it's really been amazing. And it's not because of me, but the thing is, I'm just the instrument by which they are able to do these things. I'm teaching them lessons that we never learned mm-hmm. in med school, internship, residency, fellowship, and so on. So it's really teaching physicians how to take care of themselves in a way that we've never been taught.
That sounds like you're getting some pretty amazing feedback, though. That's got to be very rewarding. And I know from my own experience in terms of setting up a home studio, mm-hmm. getting all the sound equipments and the lighting and that kind of thing, that in and of itself, it's a steep learning curve. And I'm really enjoying it. I find that learning those things does keep me energized, and I'm having a blast doing it. But it's great when you have a return on that and you get to see what kind of an impact you're making with your intended audience that you're focused on. Have you had to curtail those other activities with some of the work that you were doing with veterans in order to create the space and the time to work with specifically physicians? Has that led to a change in how you spend your time?
Well, the pandemic really put a halt on in-person education for a while. And I, you know, work for several organizations and travel nationally and teach and present for those organizations, including first responders. Mm-hmm. I work for O2X, which is an organization that creates these four-day workshops for SWAT teams, firefighters, police officers. And I just started back with them again in the last few months, traveling and presenting for them. But I think that the pandemic actually kind of shut a lot of things down in person. I just went virtual for as much as I could. And we're starting to get back into some of that again. I still am leading my weekly cancer recovery classes locally. I was online for 16 months, twice a week, voluntarily. Mm-hmm. I'm leading the classes that I've done for about 10 years now and individuals on the cancer journey. So I think like most of us, we had certain things that were shut down and other things that kind of happened thanks to the virtual space.
Okay. So it sounds like right now you are finding a lot of value in what you're currently doing. How do you see this all developing over the next 2 to 5 years? If COVID becomes sort of our normal everyday kind of experience, where it sounds like increasingly that we may always have a certain amount of COVID disease, just like we do influenza or other illnesses, and we're kind of getting back to, or we're starting to understand how we're going to live with that eventuality. But how do you see your work evolving or changing over the next 2 to 5 years? What are your plans? What would you like to do, and where would you like to be in 5 years?
I'd like every single physician to have this education.
Okay.
That would be my dream. My biggest dream, actually, is that this education, self-care education, becomes intracurricular, meaning that at the medical student level, medical students are taught from day one when they're sitting in orientation and they're looking around and they're terrified. And they're thinking, imposter syndrome, maybe I shouldn't be here. Everybody here is so smart. I don't know if I'm going to make it. And that just continues on, you know, to work at it from both ends. You know, right now I'm working mostly with the help relief suffering that exists. And I'd like to work at the let's prevent it from happening end. So that would be, you know, what I would love to do in the next, you know, 5 years. And just more of what I'm doing. I'm currently in conversation with University of North Carolina Mayhec. That's our local hospital. Mm-hmm. And we're already discussing 2022 self-care programming for healthcare professionals. We've already got 2 dates on the books for next year. And I just plan on continuing to collaborate as much as I can and present as much as I can to as many as I can.
Okay. And I know from looking at your website mm-hmm. that you have many certifications. We talked a little bit about the trauma certification. I think there was a specific certification for dealing with the oncology patients that you referenced. Mm-hmm. Which type of therapy are you finding physicians respond to most quickly, or which is most effective for them when they're dealing with this burnout, moral injury, and stress that seems so prevalent in our healthcare organizations today?
Yeah, so I believe that there's actually a self-care formula in my mind, which is that we need to learn how to take over our hijacked nervous systems, the physiology, and our hijacked minds. And that's why I'm also certified in life coaching. So for me, and what I found personally and what I found in working with my clients is that we need to first work with our physiology, because we really can't start working with our thoughts until we're calmer in our bodies. And so One of the very first things I teach physicians in my program and when they work with me privately is how to decrease the stress response and increase the relaxation response. And a really quick way to do that is through different ways that we breathe, because that's very accessible. So the first thing that I teach is the physiology behind breath, and then how can we work with it so that we can achieve a place where we start to feel calmer in the way that we breathe. And that's a very simple, accessible thing. And the second thing is, you know, I'd start to teach them somatic movement. And somatic movement is very different than stretching. So when we stretch our muscles, we are activating a stretch reflex. So back to our physiology, when we stretch a muscle, it's like a rubber band. It sends a signal to our spinal cord. Our spinal cord senses that stretch, and then it talks to the muscle and it recontracts it. And this goes on all day long. And the brain isn't involved in stretching, which is why I could say to you, Norm, you know, reach for your toes and you'd feel your hamstring stretch. And then if you stand back up, it recontracts. And you know that because if I say, okay, Norm, reach for your toes again, you would feel your hamstring stretch again. So in order to feel better in our bodies, we need to find a way to increase the resting length of our chronically tense muscles, not allow them to keep recontracting every time we stretch them. And somatic movement, which is something else that I am certified in, helps us do that. And it's amazing to me when I teach this and the physicians are like, oh my gosh, I can turn my head now. Like my head is actually turning. Like I can see behind me when I'm driving in a car without turning my whole body. So that's another really profound thing. And then the meditation piece, most of what I do is guided, right? Because sitting by yourself quietly, like, oh my gosh, that is just, nobody can do that. Not right off the bat anyway. I don't even like to do that most of the time. So creating these very accessible guided meditations based in iRest, which I described was created for Walter Reed, those components have been really, really helpful. And once they start to get that, then we can start working with the thoughts.
Okay. It sounds like your years of experience have given you a pretty specific program that you find to be most useful with physicians that you're working with and with other people that you're working with. So remind me of the timeline again. From the time you started your residency, you started to have some mild symptoms, which became more severe as you became a radiology attending. Mm-hmm. How many years would you say from the, looking back at it, from the earliest time you started having those symptoms until you realized that yoga was the answer for you, these therapies were the answer for you, how much time did that take?
Well, if I started having symptoms in residency, when I did fellowship, I practiced for 15 years, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it just crept up. You know, I think it just.
So really, we're talking 15 to 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. In retrospect, I now know that what I was experiencing, as I like to say, is that I was the only physician to correctly diagnose my illness, which was chronic stress. Mm-hmm. And that's a severe case of chronic stress. But it definitely was cumulative. It's not something like you wake up one day and you said, I'm chronically stressed and all these things are wrong. It's an adaptation. It happens over time. And it's just how my body was responding to all those crazy high levels of cortisol that I'm expecting were floating around and all the inflammation and everything else that goes along with chronic stress.
It is amazing how many physicians I talk to who have suffered from burnout for many, many years without realizing exactly what the problem was. And your example is a very dramatic example of that as well. How many physicians would you say that you have helped come to that realization through your program in the last year?
I don't know exactly how many. I mean, I've helped hundreds, but that's also through workshops and, you know, collaborations and presentations. And so I don't know. But then there's a lot of physicians, as you know, we're very proud, so I don't always hear.
Yes.
No. And I'd like to believe, even through my podcast, you know, sometimes I'll get emails from docs from my podcast. I'd like to believe that there are transformations happening that I just may not hear about, you know, that people aren't verbalizing, but that they're doing better.
Well, as I told you today on my way home, your last podcast about not saying I have to and saying I get to helped me. So that's at least one more physician that now you know you've helped.
Thank you. I've gotten a lot of emails about that one, actually. When you first hear that, you know, like, oh, I don't do that. And then you start hearing yourself talk and you say, wow, I do that. I actually do. So I'm glad that was helpful.
Yeah, for those of my listeners, just so you don't think I'm having a little inside joke with Robin here, her latest podcast was about a mindset that I think a lot of us get trapped in, and we say, you know, we have to do this. We have to finish our charts before we go home, or we have to do our charts at night instead of sitting and talking with our family and our children. And or we have even something that's enjoyable, like we're going for a bike ride on the weekend to help us, and say, oh, I have to go for that bike ride. And we get ourselves into these mental traps, I think, that make something that we should be enjoying seem like onerous and tedious. And Robin's point on the podcast was to just shift one word in that. Instead of saying, I have to, you just have to say, I get to. And I thought that was some pretty valuable information. And I did use it today myself, getting ready for recording this podcast with Robin, because it was a long day and I was rushing home and I caught myself saying, I have to record the podcast, but I stopped myself very quickly. Well, maybe we could spend a little bit of time talking about something that I like to find out from a lot of the physicians that I interview and that I talk to. I find that many physicians have a very memorable coach or mentor who was very meaningful to them during their life. And I wonder if you could share with us a story for a minute about a particular person who really led to some meaningful changes in your life and you feel as a mentor or a coach to you, Robin.
I've had so many amazing humans in my life. I feel like it's really a quilt of amazing humans, really. There hasn't been necessarily just one. And particularly in this space that I've entered in this last decade or so of my life. But there's one in particular. Her name is Eleanor Criswell. She's an octogenarian, and she is the founder of Somatic Yoga. And she's out in Northern California. She's also a psychologist and a yoga scholar and has written books and published papers. And she is the wife of the deceased Thomas Hanna of Hanna Somatics, which there are entire master's programs about, and really giving me the insight into the movement in our bodies and how we can move in a certain way and think in a certain way to release all that tension that I was describing to you, that issues in our tissues, that so much of our thinking from childhood ends up living in our bodies. And I personally had an incredible shift in studying with her and then going on to become certified in this type of movement. She has a very gentle but stern way of teaching. She was a mentor for me also in some research that I published, evaluating the effectiveness of somatic movement and meditation on CIPN, which is chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. I created a protocol for individuals on the cancer journey who were experiencing this. So not only for myself, but for those who I've had the privilege of sharing, she's just an incredible human. And she sent me a note, and I actually have it here on my desk because I refer to it frequently because it's really meaningful to me. And she said, she told me that I'm a miracle. And I said to her, what does that mean? What does miracle mean? And she said, dear Robin, a miracle is when everything, all factors, come together just right for something special to happen. It's wonderful sometimes to watch how the amazing things come together for the amazing results. I think you are a miracle person. Love, Eleanor. And it just, you know, I get teary just reading it again. And this is several years ago that she sent it to me, but you know, just having her in my life and having her really explain to me things that I never learned back in school in a way that I never knew existed, and being able to share that with the most traumatized humans I've had a chance to work with and change their lives. So Eleanor Criswell is a person that I would share with you.
Thank you very much for that story. The next thing I wanted to ask with you and I, or to ask you, is for those of my listeners who want more information about the types of training and experiences that you offer physicians who are suffering from burnout, stress disorders, and those types of things, what resources would you recommend? How can members of my audience reach out to you or contact you? I'd certainly like to include some of that information in the show notes from the show.
Yeah, so they can find me at stressfreemd.net. That's my website. And that has the link to my podcast called the Stress-Free MD Podcast, where I teach short bits of what I call stress-free snacks, like the one you described. And monthly, I have physician specialists in areas of stress that come on as well. I have a free 30-minute stress relief strategy call that they can book with me so we can figure out what best would work for them. I have the CME program, RX Inner Peace, that we referred to, which is a physician-only program, and it's worth 25 Category 1 CME, and it combines online self-paced learning as well as group and live coaching. And let's see, what else am I forgetting, Norm? Private one-on-one coaching. So some physicians say to me, you know, I just want to work with you privately so we can do that. Some physicians go through the program and want more coaching, and then they work with me privately. So lots of options. I also like to mention that I have 3 free videos on my website.
Okay.
So if you'd like to sample, you know, a breathing tool that's calming, a movement practice to remove the tension, release the tension in your neck and shoulders, and be guided through a meditation, you can look for those free videos under free offerings on my website.
Great. Well, I'll include those links in the show notes below. So for those of you who are interested in finding out more information, you'll be able to have those links. And I also think that obviously this journey that you've been on, Robin, has been something that I'm sure you didn't anticipate when you started your medical career, but it certainly sounds like it's been very fulfilling and it's taken you to places and it has led you to doing things that you never could have imagined when you got that acceptance letter to medical school. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much for taking the time to be on my show. And I look forward to hearing more about what you are able to accomplish with physicians. Burnout is such a devastating experience for all healthcare workers nowadays. I talk to nurses every day, physicians every day, who just struggle to find light at the end of the tunnel. And when we got connected, I was very excited for the opportunity to have you on my show. So thank you for coming.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you again for listening. I appreciated Robin taking time out of her busy schedule to record this interview with me. You can see why I was so excited to have Robin on the show. She has pivoted to a role that is non-traditional, but clinical. She is helping both patients and physicians manage and maintain their health and well-being. Robin's journey is an example for those physicians with an interest in pursuing non-traditional clinical roles. There are many physicians that have gravitated towards concierge medicine, functional medicine, or other disciplines considered to be non-traditional or alternative. These alternative approaches have given physicians an opportunity to tailor their practices in a manner that they find well-suited to their needs. I have included links to Robin's website, stressfreemd.net, in the show notes. There will be many other valuable links in the show notes as well. Don't forget to visit my website, physiciansbeyondthebedside.com. I am always interested in your feedback and comments about the show. By visiting the website, you'll have the opportunity to leave comments, and we can start having a discussion regarding some of your thoughts and some of the challenges you're facing or any other topics of interest to you. I always enjoy getting questions or comments from you, my listening audience. All of your feedback is very much appreciated by me. I would also encourage you to join the Facebook group that I have created, Physicians Beyond the Bedside. Visit the group and ask the administrator for permission to join the group. You can also subscribe to the podcast, Physicians Beyond the Bedside, using your favorite podcast player. Please join us for our next episode on Physicians Beyond the Bedside in 2 weeks. As always, take good care of yourselves and good luck moving beyond the bedside.